Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Use of force by police has been a very hot topic across the nation and right here in San Diego. Today, my very special guest is Jonathan Markovitz, who is a staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU of San Diego and Imperial Counties. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks very much for having me.
We're going to be speaking today specifically about use of force against the mentally ill. Now, you have recently sent a letter to the U.S. Justice Department on this issue. Tell us about that.
The letter was triggered by the death of Fridun Nahad, who was a veteran of the Afghan army who had been suffering from mental illness and from post-traumatic stress disorder. And he was killed by Officer Neil Browder last April. Officer Browder was responding to a call saying that Nahad had been violently threatening people. Officer Browder was mistakenly told that Nahad was armed with a knife.
And he wasn't. It was a ballpoint pen, right?
He wasn't armed with anything. He had a pen. And Officer Browder finds him in a dark alley, and he gets out of his car, and within seconds, he shoots Nahad dead.
Now, there's a video of this. I've watched the video. It's very disturbing. And in the video, it shows Nahad simply walking down the alley, hands at the side, walking down the alley, and all of a sudden, the officer pulls up, gets out of the car, and seconds later, he shoots, and Nahad is dead. Of course, we can't hear what, if anything, was said between them, but it certainly looked as though he was not making threats, certainly wasn't charging at the officer, and the officer certainly appeared to have had time to have gotten into his car and called for backup, even if he did, for some reason, feel threatened.
I think all of that's exactly right. One of the things that is so disturbing to the ACLU is that what you just said isn't the story that we heard at all from the police or from the district attorney at first. We were told that Nahad was violently charging the officer with a knife when he was killed. And again, only because of surveillance footage, we know that that's not true. So one other thing to just add to the mix is that the officer hadn't turned on his body camera at the time. That was a violation of police policy.
And so what has happened to this officer?
As far as we know, nothing. We know that the district attorney has declined to prosecute.
And in fact, Bonnie DeMonis has never prosecuted, am I correct, any member of the San Diego police for any police shooting, any fatal police shooting. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct. I'm not positive about that. But I should say maybe that there are two things that are disturbing about her response to this killing. One is the decision not to prosecute. And the other is the decision to, in effect, try Fridun Nahad in the press and blame him for his own death. So the constant emphasis on him as somebody who was creating reasonable fear on the part of the officer, I think, is really distressing in a lot of different ways. One of the things that she did in a press conference was to show a video of somebody else with a knife that he was twirling around. And the idea was to suggest that this person, who is clearly threatening with a knife, is somehow the kind of threat that the officer had in mind when he sees Nahad with his pen.
And the video showed it was clearly nothing like that.
Right.
Now, mentally ill people account for something like half of all officer-involved shootings or fatal shootings in the United States. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
Does this reflect more than a problem with law enforcement? Obviously, we're going to get into that. There's maybe some better things that they could do. But is this also reflective of a failing of our healthcare system in America, that we have so many mentally ill people who wind up in these confrontations with the police instead of getting the treatment that in many cases are clearly needed?
I think it clearly is. I think that it would be a problem if our letter was received as something that's just saying that there's a problem with the San Diego Police Department. Because in fact, you're absolutely right. The mentally ill lack the resources that they need in society in a huge variety of ways. They lack proper access to medical care. They also lack, and particularly in a city like San Diego, where homelessness is so high, they lack access to permanent supportive housing. And I think if we're thinking of any kind of long-term solution, we need to think about better housing, better medical care, more supportive services.
Well, certainly we're a region that has many veterans. A lot of these men and women now are coming back very damaged, PTSD, flashbacks, all kinds of issues. We've certainly had some instances locally that involve confrontations between police and veterans suffering from PTSD, from what I understand, around the county. Now, you documented several other cases. This was not the only case of a mentally ill person being shot dead by the San Diego police.
Right. And so one of the things to say is that while we're very disturbed about the killing of Ferdun Nahad, and we're very concerned about the district attorney's reaction to that killing and the lack of prosecution, the lack of accountability, what we're asking for when we write to the DOJ is an investigation into a possible pattern or practice of improper excessive force against the mentally ill. And the reason that we're asking for that is that just a examination of well-publicized cases in the last few years has revealed what seems like a troubling pattern. And I should say that we don't know the details of a lot of these cases. The Ferdun Nahad case stands out because it was captured on video and because there's an awful lot of evidence.
Yeah, here's another one I'm reading about, a Philip McMahon who was naked and pounding on his neighbor's window, apparently had broken the window, and the officers showed up and shot him through the collarbone, tore through his jugular vein. Did he die?
He didn't die.
He didn't die. Okay.
He worked, I think, at a hospital, and his coworkers saved his life. He was very gravely wounded, or very seriously wounded. And that's a case that I think stands out precisely because we really don't know an awful lot about it. He's naked, he's pounding on the window, he breaks the window. It makes total sense.
It's pretty obvious when you show up. This is probably somebody who's maybe got some issues, mental issues. The average just, you know, mean criminal isn't running around naked.
Right. So on the one hand, I think it makes complete sense for the people who live in that home to call the police.
Right, of course.
On the other hand, I think it makes complete sense for the police to show up prepared to try to de-escalate a crisis.
Yeah. Let's talk about ways to de-escalate the crisis. I know that the sheriff department here has recently started a program. Some other cities are doing it too. The name of it?
It's called PERT teams, psychiatric emergency response teams.
And
they've got different names in different cities.
So at least in theory, the way that works is if they get a call and it's a situation where the person is known to be mentally ill, and they do actually have a directory. Somebody really wants to list their family members so the officers will know before they come out if they get a call. They can do that. Or just if someone is just acting, as this gentleman was that we just discussed, where it's pretty obvious there might be a mental illness issue here. They can call and get one of these psychiatric workers to go out on the call with the officer and at least in theory to help de-escalate that.
Right.
Is that working or is it a good idea?
I think it's a great idea. So these are clinically trained social workers. I should say that they do exist as a resource for the San Diego Police Department.
So are they using that?
That's what we don't know. We know that in response to our letter to the Department of Justice, the SDPD made a big point of saying that their training focuses on de-escalation.
So they're just training the officers, or are they bringing these psychiatric experts in?
We really don't know. And a big part of what we're hoping for is greater transparency.
Yeah.
We need to know what kinds of policies and training are in place
and how
available these teams are.
I should say we don't have San Diego Police with us today. We're certainly reaching out and extending an invitation, and we'd welcome the opportunity to talk with them on the show if they'd like to come on and speak with us as well. I should point out in all fairness that, of course, in the case of Mr. Nahan, although he did have mental health issues, the officer who was called out did not know that in that particular instance. So, you know, bringing out the psych worker probably wouldn't have been the option there, but in many of these other cases, it certainly could be.
Well, I think you're right. As far as we know, there's no reason to think that the officer who shot Ferdun Nahad had any awareness of his history of mental illness.
It was more an issue was he too trigger happy?
Right.
Did he just shoot when there would have been other options, like simply talking to the guy, getting back in the car, calling for backup, making sure he really had a weapon, maybe even non-lethal force if somebody felt really threatened in a case?
I think all of that makes sense, although I wouldn't want to be too quick to rule out the possibility that a PERT team or a PERT team member could have been useful there. Anytime you get a complaint of somebody who is threatening people, which was what was said about Nahad, in a way that doesn't seem to make sense, it seems to me to make sense that a PERT team could be a valuable resource there. One thing to say about it being a good idea to have PERT training and PERT teams is that there are places where the increased availability of that training and of those teams seems to have made a difference. We don't know for sure, but one example is Seattle, where a report was just released saying that the fact that they now send out somebody with training to de-escalate, training to deal with mental health crises, on every 911 call that seems to involve somebody who's mentally ill, that policy seems to have greatly reduced the amount of violence used against the mentally ill in this kind of situation. Again,
very
I think
encouraging.
It's too early to know that for sure. And one thing to say about it is that that policy only came into effect because Seattle was investigated by the Department of Justice.
Interesting. So maybe if the Department of Justice decides to investigate here, something like that could be one of the results. That was one of my questions. Have you heard back from either the Department of Justice or the San Diego Police since you sent this letter asking the DOJ to investigate them?
So from the San Diego Police, I don't know that we've heard back. They've issued a statement, or Chief Zimmerman issued a statement, saying, and something I think everybody agrees with, no officer wants to be involved in a shooting, and saying that they make a point to, I think the word that they use is that they focus on de-escalation as in their training. And one of the things that says to us is, if that's true, that's wonderful, it's what we want. We need to know what focus means. We need to know how often people receive training. Is it every officer? How much training they receive? How available these PERT teams are? What exactly is being done? And there's really a complete lack of transparency. And on the issue of transparency, you asked about what happened to the officer who killed Nihad. And we know that there's no prosecution. We don't know whether there's been any kind of internal discipline. And right now, there's a bill pending in the Senate, Senate Bill 1286, I believe, that would finally provide some insight into how officer misconduct is treated internally. California is one of the most restrictive states in the country.
Yeah, you'd be able to get that record if an officer was involved. You'd be able to find out, has he been involved in similar incidents? What happens after
the
incidents?
And what they do, what they base their investigation on right now, the family has no idea what kind of evidence goes into the internal investigation when thinking about should this officer be held accountable for his actions.
You know, I wonder something I've never heard brought up anywhere. But that is, in this particular case of Mr. Nihad, it was an individual officer sent out all by himself in a dark alley at night. You got to wonder if he'd had a partner there who had his back, if maybe he would have been a little less, afraid, a little less apt to take such rash action. Has there been any studies that you're aware of done on comparing the rate of, say, fatal police shootings or, violent incidents involving police, officer-involved shootings, to see, is it any higher if they're out there by themselves versus if they have a partner with them?
None that I know of, but that doesn't mean that there aren't any.
I think it's a good thing for somebody to look at.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting idea. I mean, I would say that intuitively it makes sense that if one officer seems to have any kind of irrational fear, another officer may be able to talk that officer down. On the other hand, I think there are plenty of recent incidents of police killings where it doesn't seem to have helped that not every officer was afraid.
Yeah, and then there's the other end of the spectrum where we have, for example, the case in New York, the I Can't Breathe, where they had this guy that was illegally selling cigarettes was his big crime, and they basically took this guy down and strangled him to death with a whole bunch of officers standing around just watching. I was listening to an interview on NPR with, it happened to be an African-American police chief, I can't remember what city it was, but he was talking about greater accountability for officers who just stand by and do nothing. And he was implementing a policy to say that you have a duty to intervene. If you see an officer doing something wrong or about to do something wrong, let's say in a case like that, you have a duty to intervene. And if you don't, there's going to be penalties for you also.
I think that that kind of policy should be commonsensical. I mean, it absolutely makes sense. I think that touches on other issues of police accountability to citizenry, to each other, to the idea of protecting and serving the population. It touches on things like the blue wall of silence, where officers, where there is a history, at least in many places, of officers refusing to provide information about police misconduct that they're aware of. And I think it also gets to leadership. I think that it's very difficult to expect officers to hold each other accountable when the district attorney refuses to hold individual officers accountable for their misconduct, and when you have somebody like District Attorney DeMantis, mm-hmm. Trying somebody like Ferdoun Nahad for his own death in the court of public opinion, mm-hmm. And refusing to hold the officer who shot him accountable in any kind of public way, at least.
Yeah, not even a manslaughter, let alone murder charge.
Right, I mean, no charges at all, and nothing, no public statements that indicate that there's anything wrong with his actions.
It would seem to send a message to other officers that basically, no matter what you do, we're not going to do anything.
The misconduct isn't a thing. It's not something that we're interested in combating. And I hope that that's not true. I hope that there really is a sense that officers are accountable for serving the public responsibly. Yeah. But again, statements like the ones that have been issued about the Nahad killing suggest that that might not be the case.
Yeah, we've certainly seen other areas that have handled better. I know in Europe, mm-hmm. they have a whole different way of approaching this, and they don't seem to have this problem to the degree that we have it in the United States. I know here in East County we've had cases where I think the police are probably to be commended for that, how they de-escalated situations. I can think of one recently where they went to the door and somebody fired two shots through the door at the officer on the porch. Thankfully didn't hit him, and I'm sure in many jurisdictions this guy would have wound up dead, but they were able to defuse that and just wait a while and mm-hmm. talk him out. Another well-publicized case where you had a guy who had actually murdered his wife and kidnapped some children and was up on a bridge, and they'd stopped him with whatever it was, tack strips or something. He was getting out of the car with one of the kids, and they managed to use, I believe it was a beanbag. It was a form of a non-lethal weapon, even in such an extreme case where if there was ever a case of maybe justifying lethal force, it would be to stop a guy who's kidnapped four kids and killed their mother. And yet even there, they managed to stop that without resorting to gunfire that, of course, could also hurt the children, maybe.
So I think that the availability of different means and especially different training that could lead to de-escalation is really important. And I should say that mm-hmm. I don't know that that's not happening in San Diego. I just know that there are cases where it seems not to.
Yeah.
And that we just don't know how much de-escalation training there
True.
Is.
True. I mean, we may not know. There may, in all fairness, again, the cops aren't here. There could be many cases where they've been able to stop or defuse a situation without shooting somebody.
Right.
And we're not hearing about those. We hear about the ones that make the news where something goes wrong.
And I think that's right. I mean, I think it would be great to know when the police are particularly effective at de-escalation, partly because those instances could be pointed to as models for police behavior more broadly. But I think it also is right that attention really focus on the cases where that doesn't happen, because we need, again, to make sure the police are held accountable so that they do protect and serve. So, for example, one of the other cases in our letter is the case of Jamal O'Day, who was a Burmese refugee who was having a mental health crisis, had threatened his family, and his sister calls the police because he's in a crisis. The family manages to leave the home by the time the police arrive.
So he's in there by himself.
He's armed with he's holding, I don't want to say armed with, because at this point he's not threatening anyone anymore mm-hmm. because the family is gone. But when the police show up, he's got a knife and he's got a stick. He's not able to communicate very effectively in English. The police don't wait for a translator. They don't try to communicate with him through a bullhorn.
And there was no crisis. Everybody was out, so they could have just kind of waited him out and got somebody to talk him down in his own language, perhaps,
They could have waited. They could have employed a variety of de-escalation tactics. Instead, they knock the door down. They send a police dog in. He grabs a machete and injures the dog, at which point they shoot and kill him. And there are many things to point to as a tragedy in this.
Yeah.
But one big thing is that the sister makes the call thinking that she's going to get help for her brother, and instead is left devastated by the thought that she's responsible for his death, that making that phone call was in effect signing his death warrant.
Yeah, heartbreaking.
And I think that that's the thing that we want to avoid. We want to make sure that people whose family members are experiencing mental health crises can call the police, can call for the help that they need, and can have a sense that when they're doing that, they're not jeopardizing the lives of their loved ones. They actually are going to get the help that they need.
Beyond trying to get reforms for the police procedures, what more ought to be done to protect the mentally ill? It certainly seems that ever since the 80s, when Reagan closed the mental hospitals and let everybody out, there were probably a lot of people who were in there that shouldn't have been, but maybe some who perhaps were safer there. But we're certainly seeing a lot more very mentally ill people either on the streets or they're with family, but they're just not able to get the treatment that they need. The family can't afford it. It's the insurance won't cover it.
Right.
You know, there's delays getting in places.
Right.
You know, if you could wave your magic wand, what else should be done here so that we wind up not having half of the police, half of the people that police kill across America being mentally ill.
Yeah. Well, so I think that you're right to point to deinstitutionalization as part of the problem. And again, you're also right to say that there were some very important reasons for that and some people who were institutionalized who probably shouldn't have been. But I think what happened then is that the mentally ill wind up being adrift. They wind mm-hmm. up having very few resources, and they reach the point where today nobody really has responsibility for this incredibly vulnerable population, and it becomes a population that, and mental health crises in general, become something that is dealt with where the first and the frontline response is, and the frontline profession dealing with it, is law enforcement. And I think that by itself is a huge problem.
Yeah.
So things that should be done, I think, include the reforms that we can talk even more about, for the police themselves, and greater transparency, I think, is really important. But also things like better access to medical care, better access to a huge variety of supportive services, and better access to permanent supportive housing. Mm-hmm. I think that you can't separate the mental health crisis from the homelessness crisis in San Diego or nationwide.
Very true. Well, Jonathan, I'm going to give you the last word here. We've been speaking, listeners, with Jonathan Markovitz, who's a staff attorney from the ACLU, about their efforts to get the U.S. Justice Department to investigate the San Diego police over the killings of mentally ill people, which has been a problem not only here, but across the nation, with half of the fatal police shootings approximately in the entire U.S. being people who are mentally ill. Jonathan, what else would you like our listeners to know that we haven't already talked about today?
I think the only other thing to mention is that what we're hoping comes from this letter is partly a Department of Justice investigation, because I think that by itself can shed a lot more light on the problem. We're also hoping for better training of officers. We're hoping for better availability of PERT teams. And we're hoping for greater transparency in general. We mentioned the Senate bill, Senate Bill 1286, that is making its way through committees and hearings now. I think the big thing to leave with is just that we don't know the scope of the problem. We don't know the scope of the response to the problem. And it's obviously the problem itself is almost certainly way bigger than anything that we were able to document. And the response has to be proportionate, and we have to know what that response is.
California's Attorney General Kamala Harris recently implemented an open justice database that she's rolling out that is going to be a place where people, I understand, will be able to go look up certain portions of this data on, you know, how many officer-involved shootings there have been, fatal or otherwise, I think. So we're going to see a little bit of improvement in that, but certainly there would seem to be a lot more room for reforms and transparency and definitely more protections perhaps for the mentally ill.
I think that makes sense. I think that the database will be very valuable. I think that on its own, it's not going to let us know about things like how departments are dealing with police misconduct and what kinds of disciplinary measures are being implemented. So we need more than that, but certainly that's important.
Yeah, very good. Well, I want to thank you so much, Jonathan, for taking the time out of your day to join us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.